Cooperation is the key to success in life. Your ability to interact effectively with other people, to negotiate, persuade, and to communicate with others in such a way that they help you to achieve your goals is essential to everything that happens to you. Without exception, the most respected and highly paid men and women in our society are those who have developed their abilities to be influential in their interactions with other people in every aspect of their work and personal lives. There is a law of control that says that you feel positive about yourself to the degree to which you feel you are in control of your own life. It also says that you feel negative about yourself to the degree to which you feel you are not in control. Psychologists call this locus of control theory. They say that each person feels their life is controlled by either internal or external factors. A person with an internal locus of control feels that he or she is in charge and is making the decisions that determine the direction of his or her life. The person with an external locus of control, on the other hand, feels that others are in charge and that he or she is controlled by external factors and influences. In order to be happy and to enjoy high levels of self-confidence, you have to organize your life in such a way that you feel very much in control of what happens to you. And nowhere is this more important than in your ability to get the things you want through others. To accomplish anything worthwhile, you need the help of lots and lots of other people. To achieve your full potential as a human being, you need to consciously structure your entire life so that you are surrounded by harmonious, cooperative relationships. Your job is to be able to draw upon the organized efforts of many people to help move you in the direction that you want to go. And you really have no choice but to become good in this area. Basically, you can either influence others or you can be influenced by them. You can learn how to persuade others to your way of thinking and to helping you, or you can simply let yourself be persuaded to the ways of thinking of others and to helping them. This is the real difference between feeling powerful and feeling powerless, between being an active agent and being a victim. Learning how to get what you want through others on a consistent basis makes you feel strong and effective. Every time you achieve a goal with the help and cooperation of other people, you feel more competent and capable. The men and women with the highest levels of self-confidence are those who, through hard work and experience, have reached the point where they've become very skilled in working effectively with different kinds of people to achieve their goals. In reality, everything in life revolves around your relationships. Your relationships will determine your success or failure and how fast you achieve your goals. They'll determine your level of happiness and confidence and self-esteem. Your ability to influence, persuade, and earn the cooperation of others is an indispensable part of everything you become. I've been teaching professional selling for many years, and one of the things I've learned is that everyone is in the field of sales. Everyone earns their living by selling something to someone. From the time that you take your first job to the time you retire, and for all the days of your life, you are always either selling or being sold to. Let me define selling for a moment. Selling is the ability to persuade another person to cooperate with you in achieving a mutual goal. Every kind of negotiation and persuading involves selling of some kind or another. Every act of parenting requires selling your children on good values and behaviors, on cooperating and helping. Your job is to approach everything you do from this viewpoint and then to learn the skills you need to become very competent in getting your point across and persuading others to your point of view. There are several areas where your ability to get the things you want can make a real difference in your life. To start with, there's your job or work. More than 80% of people working today would rather be earning more money or doing something else in their same company or working at a different job altogether. But they continue to stay where they are, earning far less money than they're capable of earning, and working at a job that they don't really like. And this happens because they don't know how to act in their best interest to change things. Happy, self-confident people have developed the ability to structure things in such a way that they always seem to be getting what they want. Meanwhile, people who haven't learned how to negotiate in their best interest always seem to be getting stuck with second best or with something that's less than what they had wanted or hoped for. And the same techniques that you use to be influential in one part of your life can be fairly easily applied to other parts of your life as well, as you'll soon see. We've already come a long way from the beginning of this program. The starting point of getting the things you want is to be very clear about what they are. Then, you start from your goal and you work back to the present day. First you visualize, and then you think on paper. You consider all the steps that you would have to take to get from where you are to where you want to go and then back again. And then you make a list of all the people whose cooperation you'll require in order to achieve those objectives. The most powerful tool that you have for improving your life is your mind and your ability to think. Unfortunately, as Thomas Edison once said, there is no expedient to which the average person will not go to avoid the hard labor of thinking. It's probably true, but it can work to your advantage if you develop the habit of applying your powerful brain to your situation before you start out. Peter Drucker, the management guru, once said that action without thinking is the cause of every failure. If this is true, then it means that action preceded by thinking is the cause of every success. This is probably why Thomas J. Watson Sr., the founder of IBM Corporation, had signs made up with the word think, and he had them posted in every office and on every wall in the company. This constant reminder to think helped to make IBM one of the most powerful and most respected companies in the world. Once you've decided what you really want and whose help you will need to achieve it, you think through the basic selling process as it applies to this person or situation, and you're ready to begin the influence process. First, there's the need to meet the person and to establish rapport and trust with that person. Today, the quality of trust underlies all relationships. The most successful people are those who invest a lot of time and energy building up high-quality, trust-based relationships, and then they maintain them over time. Smart people are those who take a long-time perspective with other people, and they think about interacting with them for many years to come. They think about the third and fourth and fifth interaction with the same person while they're still engaged in the first, and they behave accordingly. In the process of establishing trust, you ask questions to find out what the person's needs and problems are, and then you listen carefully and attentively to the answers, as we've discussed in a previous session. Everyone is tuned in to their favorite radio station, WIIFM. This stands for What's in it for me? You have to tune into their wavelength and find out what it is that they need and want, or what problems they have that you can help them solve, before you can expect them to want to help you to achieve your goals. Once you've established rapport and identified problems and needs by asking questions, you'll then be in a position to present solutions and benefits. These are the ways that you can help the other person fulfill their needs or solve their problems. My friend Zig Ziglar says, "You can get anything you want in life if you just help enough other people get what they want." And he is certainly right. If you follow the steps properly up to now, and you've demonstrated to the other person how you can help him or her get what he or she wants, you're in a position to ask for action. You can now ask the person for what you want and for what you need. All you have to do is ask. Once you have rounded the bases, you cross home plate by asking confidently and expectantly for the things you want. This last part might seem obvious, but according to studies at Columbia University, fully 50% of sales presentations end without the salesperson asking the customer to make any decision at all. They just thank them for their time and leave, hoping to be able to come back some other day. If you only learned one thing from this entire program that would dramatically raise your self-confidence and self-esteem and markedly increase the quality of your life, it would be to develop the habit of asking confidently for whatever you want from whoever you happen to be dealing with. I've seen very ordinary-looking men who have obtained dates with and even married very beautiful women simply because they persisted in asking, and the odds worked out in their favor. I've seen countless people get outstanding jobs at ridiculously high salaries because they had the audacity to ask boldly for what they wanted, and someone gave it to them. When you ask politely and persistently, you cannot possibly lose. Before you ask, you have nothing. If the person says no, you're back in the same position that you were in before you asked. You may not have gained anything, but you haven't lost anything either. But if a person says yes, and eventually someone will, then you're far further ahead than another person who didn't bother to ask at all. I know a young man who started his fortune by going out and making what he called 60% offers on houses that were for sale. Whatever the list price was, he would offer 60% cash immediately, no questions asked, for the house. And it's true that he got turned down 99 times out of 100. But by calmly persisting, he ended up buying house after house, each of which he was able to mortgage for more than the purchase price, rent out, and eventually resell later at a far higher price. Many people are unhappy in their jobs, but they have no idea how to change, and because they have little or no savings, they are afraid to lose the job they have. They eventually settle into a comfort zone, and instead of looking for ways to get out, they use their reasoning powers to justify staying in their situation. Many thousands of people have obtained better jobs and better salaries in better locations by following the instructions I'm about to give you here. This is simply the formula for what is called creative job search. It's one of the best ways to put your entire career onto the fast track, and it works with a 95% level of success for anyone who tries it. The first step in getting the job you want is to identify and define your ideal job with perfect clarity. Decide what part of the country you want to work in, what kind of company you want to work for, what kind of people you want to associate with, and especially, what kind of work do you enjoy doing day in and day out? This may take a good deal of reading and research, and you may decide that you want to get into a different field. A recent study showed that 4 years out of college, fully 80% of graduates were working in fields different from the ones they had prepared for. The average adult in America in his or her working lifetime will have 10 full-time jobs, each lasting more than 3 years, and 4 full careers, each one different from the one before. So it's not unusual to change jobs. What is unusual and unjustifiable is to stay at a job if you're not really happy at it. The second step is for you to go out and do informational interviewing. You don't go out and look for a job. You go out and look for a company where you might want to work. The only way that you can decide if this is the kind of company and job that you want is by interviewing your prospective employer. Fully 85% of the job market in America is hidden. It is not written down, and it's not advertised. Many jobs are filled because people just show up when the job or the need for a particular type of person happens to occur. In your informational interviewing process, you phone up and ask for 10 minutes to get a person's opinions about that particular field. Most people will give you 10 minutes to answer your questions if you tell them that you're considering going to work in this particular industry and you are doing research. In your 10-minute interview, ask about the industry, its prospects for growth, its major competitors, its strengths and vulnerabilities, and where the opportunities are in the future. At the end of 10 minutes, keep your word and offer to leave. If you're invited to stay longer, by all means do so, but never, never ask for or suggest that you are looking for a job at this meeting. You are merely seeking information. What this meeting does is to give both of you an opportunity to assess each other in a non-threatening situation. You get a chance to look at him or her and the company and determine if this is the kind of place where you would like to invest your work and your life. The other person gets an opportunity to look at you objectively without being under any pressure to assess you or make any kind of a decision. Repeat this exercise with as many different companies as possible in the type of business or industry where you have decided to work. Go to the library and do research on the industry. Read everything you can get your hands on. Ask questions of people in the business. Once you've completed your research, you can make a decision on where you want to work and what you want to do and what's in it for them. You then call the person that you've decided to work for and ask for another appointment. Tell him or her that you have now completed your research into this industry and you would like to share your findings. All of this can be done before or after work or at lunchtime while you're still working somewhere else. When you meet with a decision maker, tell the individual what you've found out about this industry and tell him or her that you've decided that you want to work for him or her doing this specific job. Describe the job that you want to do and describe why it is you feel that you could do this job in an exemplary fashion. Explain the kind of contribution you could make to this business and why it makes good sense for him or her to hire you in this position. You can create a job by convincing an employer that, by hiring you, he or she can gain or save more money than you cost. Then, the hiring decision is easy. Not long ago, I conducted a seminar on advanced selling skills for a high-tech company. The sales manager who brought me in to give this talk also took me out to the airport afterwards. He told me that he'd gone through this exact process and decided that this company offered a splendid opportunity for a sales manager, which they didn't have. He also told me that it took him fully 5 months of working on the president of this company before he was finally given the job with the responsibilities and the salary for which he was asking. He had taken full charge of his own working life and was now doing exactly what it was he had decided he wanted to do, and he was doing it in exactly the company that he had settled upon as a result of his research process. If you've done your homework properly, you should have a pretty good idea of the kind of money you can ask for. And here is where you begin to both sell and negotiate. If the individual offers you a job, it means that you have made a sale. But before you accept the job, you're in one of the best negotiating positions you will ever be in. So the rule is this: never accept a job or a salary offer the first time it is made. Thank him or her very much for the offer and excuse yourself, saying that you are going to think about it very seriously and you would like to meet with him or her again in a couple of days. In making you a salary offer, the employer's job is to pay no more than is absolutely necessary to avoid losing you. The first salary offer will usually be 10 to 20% below what the employer is actually willing to pay if he or she has gone so far as to offer you the job in the first place. When you come back, you have a certain amount of power that you must use very carefully. You tell the employer that you're very interested in taking the job, but that based on your research and on the contribution you feel you can make, you think that the job should pay about 20% more than he or she has offered. Give the prospective employer the specific amount that you would like to earn on a monthly and on an annual basis. Then smile and remain perfectly silent. Be prepared to ask for more time to think about it or even to walk away if the salary offer is too low. However, in most cases, the employer will raise the offer substantially because now he or she, having made up his or her mind about hiring you, doesn't want to have to lose you and start over. And here's a rule with regard to negotiating. It's called the Rule of Four. This rule simply says that there are basically four issues to be decided in any negotiation. There is a major or central issue, and there are three smaller issues. Once you've agreed on salary, you need to agree on three more issues. The first issue is your next increase in pay, when it comes and what you can do to earn it. Ask for a specific standard of performance or a specific time period. The second smaller issue in negotiating a job is the total benefit package. Does the job include a car, expenses, medical insurance, dental insurance, holidays, vacations with pay, sick days, and so on? And the third issue, equally important, is your exact role and responsibilities. What kind of training will you receive? What kind of backup or support will you be given? What are all the peripheral details that will affect your ability to do your job in an excellent fashion? These are things that you want to be clear about before you begin, because they can often become considerably fuzzy later on. About 3 years ago, a young woman who had been working in my office for 6 months told me she wanted to talk to me about her salary. I had hired her as a junior secretary at $850 a month, and because she had worked so hard and done so well, I had raised her salary to $1,000 a month. I knew she wanted another increase, and I was planning to give her an extra $150 a month, bringing her up to $1,150, almost a 40% increase in just 6 months. When we sat down to talk, she told me, as I expected, that she felt she was worth more money because she had made herself more valuable. I told her that I agreed and that I was going to give her an increase of $150 a month. She smiled pleasantly and thanked me for the thought, and then she explained that a $150 a month increase wouldn't be enough. She explained her reasons. She told me that 6 months ago, when she started, we had purchased a computer, and she had, by taking classes evenings and weekends, learned how to operate it quite efficiently. She had also learned how to do the basic accounting for our company, and by practicing constantly, she had brought her typing speed up to about 70 words per minute. She had learned several of our products and had proven herself quite capable of making sales over the phone when inquiries came in. She explained all this to me and said that she had inquired at 3 different employment agencies to find out what a person with her skills might be worth. She informed me very politely and pleasantly that she was now worth $1,500 to $1,600 per month, and went on to say that if I wanted to replace her, that's how much I would have to pay if I went out into the marketplace. As she spoke, I realized to myself that she was right. I also realized that if I attempted to replace her, the cost and the confusion would be far more expensive than the increase she was asking for. Although it was far beyond what I had decided to give, I realized that I had no choice but to cave in and agree to increase her salary from $1,000 a month to $1,500 a month. Not only did she almost double her income within 6 months and get a 50% increase at this one meeting alone, but she was worth every penny of it, and I didn't mind giving it to her at all. I've subsequently found that most employers don't mind giving an increase if the employee can make a good case for it and convince the employer that the increase asked for is fair, considering the contribution the person is making. Some people are good at negotiating in their best interest, and some people are not. One of your main jobs in life, and one that will lead to increasing levels of self-confidence for you, is to become more effective at influencing others by learning how to negotiate more skillfully. Contrary to popular belief, top negotiators are not hard bargainers and tough-minded realists. They are not aggressive and pushy and demanding. They do not coerce their negotiating partners into unsatisfactory agreements. The best negotiators are invariably very pleasant people. You have an almost automatic tendency to trust them and to feel that what they're asking for is in the best interest of both parties. They look for what are called win-win agreements, where both parties are happy with the results of the negotiation. Good negotiators seem to ask a lot of questions and are very concerned to understand exactly what it is you're trying to achieve from the negotiation. For example, in buying a house, both parties might start off arguing and disagreeing over the price. They begin with the position that the price is the most important thing and that this is all that has to be negotiated. The skilled negotiator, however, will realize that price is only one part of the package. This negotiator will help both parties to see that the terms of the sale are also important, as are the furniture and fixtures that might be included in the transaction, the amount that the vendor might take back as a second mortgage, the interest rates to be charged on the various parts of the purchase or sale, and the time and conditions of occupancy are all important to the sale. Finally, good negotiators are very patient, and they concentrate first on getting agreement on all the parts of the contract that the two parties have in common before they go on to seeking for amicable ways to settle the other issues. They also take the time to get clarity and understanding on each point as they go along so that there's no confusion later. There's nothing that raises your self-confidence faster than to feel that you have been successful in negotiating a contract and that you have gotten a good deal as a result. And there's nothing that will lower your self-confidence faster than to think that you have been out-negotiated into a poor deal that you'll have to live with. So negotiating skills are an important part of your personality development and of your sense of personal effectiveness. The first skill in successful negotiating, and some people say that this is 90% of success, is preparation. Preparation is the key. The more and better prepared you are prior to a negotiation, the more likely it is that the outcome of the negotiation will be satisfactory. Preparation requires that you do two things. First, get all the information you possibly can about the upcoming negotiation. Second, think the negotiation through carefully from beginning to end and be fully prepared for any eventuality. Begin by finding out everything you possibly can about the situation. If you're thinking of buying a house, take the time to go out and look at 50 to 100 houses and then sit down and compare the various sizes and selections and amenities and costs and sales prices. If you're thinking of buying a car or a stereo set or a product that's available in more than one place, phone all over town to find out how much you can get it for. Always be sure to ask this key question. What's the best deal I can get on this if I buy it today? If you're going to be negotiating with a particular person, find out as much as you possibly can about that person. Speak to other people who have done business with that person and ask for their insights and for their advice on how to negotiate more effectively. Perhaps the most important form of information is your knowledge of alternatives to this negotiation. A basic rule for success and happiness in life is that you are only as free as your well-developed options. If you have only one choice, you are in a very poor position to negotiate in your best interests. But if you have consciously developed a variety of options, not only with this negotiation, but in terms of other solutions to your problems, you're going to get a far better deal for yourself than if there was only one thing that you could do. One of the greatest strengths you can have in any negotiation is to be able to get up and walk away. On the other hand, the more intensely you desire to buy or sell something, and the fewer alternatives you have, the less negotiating power you'll be able to bring to bear in the discussion. Excellent negotiators are able to ride the fine line between wanting to achieve the subject of the negotiation and simultaneously appearing not to really care whether it works out or not. Another form of power in negotiating is timing. You must give careful consideration to exactly when you will sit down to negotiate. For example, in organizations that run on a monthly basis and which have monthly sales targets to meet, you can always negotiate your very best deal in the last few days of the month. In the first few days of the month, there's very little urgency to compromise or make concessions. But as the time to meet monthly quotas gets closer, the people in charge of sales in any organization become more eager to cut corners and make deals. Whenever you possibly can, give careful thought to the timing of any negotiation, and remember, patience almost always tends to work in your favor. And here's an important point. Whenever you present people with something new or with an unexpected alternative, be willing to give them a couple of days to think about it. Encourage them to turn over the new price or terms or conditions in their minds and let them come back to you. If you're patient, people who may be totally opposed to your suggestion when you first bring it up will often come around completely and agree to go along with it if you just give them a little time. And finally, in getting the things you want, remember that no negotiation is ever final. If you find that the situation has changed and that you're no longer satisfied with the terms and conditions of the deal, be willing to go back and reopen the negotiation. Be willing to go back and suggest changes that make the deal more fair and equitable for both parties, and especially yourself. As we said before, and it can't be repeated too often, in all acts of influence, persuasion, and negotiation, the keys to success are to research thoroughly, plan carefully, work systematically, and don't be afraid to ask. Develop the habit of asking for a better deal, for better terms, for better conditions, for better prices, both in buying and selling. Ask for a better job or different responsibilities or for a higher salary or for different benefits. Ask for opportunities. Ask your customers to buy. Ask your suppliers for better prices. Whatever you're offered, always consider it an opening bid, and rather than accepting it the first time, ask for something better. And the more you ask, the better will be your results. And the better your results, the happier and more self-confident you feel, and the more capable you'll be of getting a better deal for yourself in every area of your life. You'll eventually become an expert on getting the things you want, and every time you succeed, you will feel more like the winner that you are meant to be. It's a fact of life that dealing with difficult, angry, obnoxious, or negative people can do more to undermine your self-confidence in the short term than almost any other single experience you can endure. Fully 85% of all the happiness or unhappiness that you experience will come from your interactions with other people. It always seems to be people problems that disrupt our lives, diminish our self-esteem, lower our effectiveness, and distract us from the things in life that we really enjoy. In this session, you will learn how to cope with difficult people and how to remain positive and in control with even the most troublesome type of person in the most negative of situations. A key ability of all high achievers, all men and women with high levels of self-confidence and self-esteem, is that they know within themselves that they can function effectively with a great variety of people and personalities. In fact, one of the measures of self-esteem is the number of different types of people you can get along with. Anyone can get along with people having normal or steady personalities. But the real test for how far you've come is when you can balance competing interests and interact effectively with a tremendous variety of human complexities and eccentricities. Coping with difficult people is a vital personality skill that can be extremely helpful to you in enabling you to travel further and faster in a shorter period of time towards your goals. At work, you often have to deal with difficult people. Even if you get along famously with everyone at your job, but you have problems with just one other person, that in itself will often be enough to negatively affect everything you do. Because we're so influenced by the words and behaviors of others, a single problem with another person can cause us to be preoccupied and unhappy for most of the day. Whenever you find yourself not getting along with a coworker or boss or subordinate or someone you have to work with, you become distracted and your productivity can drop off considerably. For example, the worst times a person spends at any job are when they're not getting along well with their boss. Whenever you experience friction between you and your boss, you'll tend to be preoccupied most of the time and think about your situation continually, even when you're not at work. You'll take it home with you, and it'll affect your family relationships. It may affect your sleep and your health. And this is because your self-image and your self-esteem is largely determined by the way you're treated by those who are important to you and whom you respect. When your boss or a significant coworker seems to be unhappy with you for any reason, it can throw a shadow over your whole life. If you're in sales, a rude customer or prospect can really shake your confidence in yourself and your happiness with your job. Dealing with difficult customers on a regular basis can often cause you to think of changing fields, and many people do. If you own your own business or if you're in a senior position in your company, you often have to deal with difficult bankers and suppliers. If your banker is mad at you or unhappy with you and your business for any reason, he can make your life miserable. So smart and successful people are those who do everything possible to ensure that their relationships with their bankers are first rate, and at the first sign of trouble, they immediately act to diffuse any problems or misunderstandings that might arise. At home and in your personal relationships, there will always be friction and room for misunderstandings. As a human relations expert, one of your jobs is to assure harmony and happiness in your relations with others. And this often consists of settling arguments and resolving problems. Even the nicest of people are sometimes difficult to get along with, and your job is to keep this in mind while you go to work to untangle a difficult human situation or to smooth out ruffled feathers. As a consultant and trainer to many companies, I'm amazed at how many people are being held back from happiness and achievement in their lives and in their careers by their unwillingness to deal in a constructive and straightforward manner with the problem people in their lives. Shakespeare suggests that we take arms against a sea of troubles and in so doing, end them. When you have a people problem, the answer is to attack it straightforwardly. In a recent study of managers and employees, they were all given a simple test and asked how they would prefer to be dealt with if they were doing or saying something or causing a problem that was offending or upsetting another person. They were given examples of having bad breath or needing to use more deodorant or talking too loud on the telephone and disturbing nearby workers or having some personality quirk that bothered other people. In their answers, the people in this study almost unanimously agreed that they would prefer it if people were to confront them in a straightforward way and tell them, without dressing it up, exactly what the problem was so that they could deal with it. They felt that they were quite capable of taking constructive feedback, and they much preferred it to having people going around being unhappy or upset or talking about them behind their backs. They all felt that they were strong enough to deal with any direct criticism and were capable of evaluating any feedback to determine whether or not it was valid and whether or not they should act upon it. Then, the people in the study were given another test. They were asked how they would go about resolving a variety of problems with other people. If another person had bad breath or body odor or was engaging in behaviors that bothered or offended other people, they were asked how they would resolve these issues. And here's the interesting part. The same people who said that they preferred to be dealt with in a straightforward manner almost all felt that other people were too sensitive for direct talk or straightforward action. They wrote that they would have to take careful steps to bring these things to the attention of other people. Their answers included leaving unsigned notes on the person's desk or windshield of their car, or sending anonymous letters in the mail, or contacting the spouses or friends of the other person and having them bring these problems to the person's attention, or even building up gradually over a period of time to actually talking with the person, making subtle suggestions for a change or improvement. Most people believe that others are too fragile and incapable of straight talk, so they engage in a variety of subterfuges, from ignoring the behavior and repressing their feelings to being extremely careful so that they don't hurt anyone's feelings when they point out a problem that might exist. Probably the greatest single fear experienced by men and women in our society today is the fear of confrontation. People seem to be absolutely traumatized at the very idea of confronting another human being for any reason and under almost any circumstances. Psychologists explain to us that people engage in suppression of their true feelings by often pretending that everything is fine and that there's nothing the matter. They also engage in repression, where they push their angry emotions deep into their subconscious minds but below their levels of awareness rather than to deal with the problem squarely. And the most common psychological phenomenon is that of denial. Denial is not only the most widespread, but probably the worst of all the psychological mechanisms that people use to avoid confrontation and openness. People engage in denial when they refuse to face something in their lives that's making them unhappy. Denial is a form of repression that creates enormous stress, both psychological and physical. There's an old saying, "What the mind harbors, the body expresses." If one is denying or refusing to deal with something minor, if it persists for any period of time, the individual might contract a minor ailment. These seem to be ways of reacting to the fact that a person feels overworked and underappreciated. If what a person is not facing or dealing with is major, that is, a lot of ego or embarrassment is involved, he or she may come down with a major illness. On the other hand, elaborate tests have shown that people who confront on a regular basis are far healthier mentally and physically than people who deny and evade problems, hoping that they'll go away or resolve themselves on their own. This is why the ability to honestly confront a stressful situation or a difficult person is an absolute prerequisite for self-confidence and self-esteem. So we ask, what causes a person to be afraid to confront? And this takes us right back to the beginning of personality development in early childhood. Although each person has a certain temperament and a certain type of personality that seems to be genetic in origin, virtually all of our behaviors, values, beliefs, fears, and attitudes are learned starting in early childhood. We learn to be afraid just as we learn to be brave. We learn to be positive and outgoing just as we learn to be negative and introverted. Everything we are or ever will be is a result of ideas or experiences we have had. These thoughts or ideas are then mixed with emotions and deposited into our subconscious minds, where they take on a power of their own. As infants, we start off completely unafraid of anything or anyone. The infant will touch and taste and feel and smell and get into anything in an attempt to explore his or her environment. He or she is completely trusting, and willing to take on anything and anyone who comes along. This is the quality of being completely unafraid, and it is your normal, natural birthright. You are born with it. In addition, the child is completely spontaneous. The child laughs and cries and giggles and gurgles and throws himself around and does anything he or she darn well pleases. The child is completely uninhibited and feels no need to please anyone. The child feels no pressure to conform to anybody's standards or requirements. And this state of being completely spontaneous and uninhibited is also your natural birthright. It is an inherent part of your personality. Well, you might ask, why is it that so few adults retain this feeling of mental and emotional freedom when they grow up? This is the question, and the answer is not simple. When children are very young, many parents begin to make mistakes with them by attempting to influence and control them in a negative way. The most common behavior that parents use to direct and control their children is destructive criticism, often coupled with physical punishment. Most parents have no idea how sensitive the growing child is or how significant their criticisms are in forming the young personality. If a child touches and tastes and smells different things, often things that may be dangerous to the child, the parent will often shout and spank the child and tell the child to stop and get away from there. If the child is continually criticized or punished for exploring his or her environment, the child will experience fear associated with anything new or different. When the child grows up, he or she will experience the fear of failure associated with anything new or different or risky. This fear of failure then becomes the major obstacle to success in adult life. As an adult, a child who experienced destructive criticism growing up will often be extremely tense about doing or saying anything where he might make a mistake. His entire inclination will be to play it safe. He will avoid risks of almost any kind. He will settle for a job that is beneath him, a relationship that's not challenging, a social circle that's boring, and a range of activities that are easily within his comfort zone, rather than to take a chance and trigger the fear of failure and the low self-esteem that goes with it. Mind you, no one says that they're refusing to do something because of the fear of failure. Instead, they create elaborate rationalizations and justifications and give themselves very good reasons for their course of behavior. But there are always two reasons for doing anything. There is the reason that sounds good, and behind it, there is the real reason. People tend to put a favorable interpretation on any action that they either take or refuse to take. They always give you the good reason. But the real reason is often that the decision enables them to feel safer and more secure. It offers greater protection for their self-esteem. It allows them to stay within their comfort zone and not risk loss of any kind. It enables them to give in to the fear of failure and feel safe. Another effect of destructive criticism on the growing child is the feeling that he or she only has value to the degree to which he or she does what mommy or daddy wants. This is called conditional love. The parents make it clear, and often they do this accidentally, that the only time they totally love and accept the child is when he or she is performing up to their expectations. If you grow up feeling that you were never completely loved by one or both of your parents, you'll have a natural tendency to believe that it was because there was something inherently defective in you as a person. You will believe as an adult that you are not good enough. Many adults are preoccupied with the thought that they are not good enough. They reach maturity with low self-esteem and they see themselves in a negative light in almost every situation. They compare themselves unfavorably with others, and they see others as being better than they are and possessed of higher intelligence and greater capabilities. They tend to see their previous experiences in a negative light, highlighting the mistakes and errors and ignoring the times when they did well. A combination of destructive criticism plus a perceived lack of love from one or both parents will often cause a child to grow up feeling that he is not worth very much. This feeling of worthlessness leads to feelings of guilt. And guilt today is considered to be the biggest single emotional problem of the 20th century. If a person is brought up feeling unworthy in the eyes of his or her parents, he or she will behave as an unworthy person as an adult. No matter how hard the person tries on the outside to achieve success, deep down inside, he feels that he doesn't really deserve it, that he isn't worth it, or that it will be taken away from him even if he does achieve it. Often, men and women who have worked extremely hard to achieve material success begin to engage in self-sabotage. They begin to drink too much, or take dope, or fool around in their marriages, or do other things that cause them to lose what they worked so hard for. If you've been brought up with conditional love, very early in life you will develop what is called a fear of rejection. This fear of rejection is the major obstacle to success and happiness in adult relationships. People who experience this fear of rejection become overly concerned and often preoccupied with the thoughts, feelings, and opinions of other people. If continued long enough, they reach the point where they cannot do or say anything for fear that someone else may not approve. Fully 90% of salespeople in America today have some form of the fear of rejection. As a result, they call on fewer people, they make worse presentations, they ask for the order less often, and they live lives that are far below what they're really capable of. These fears of rejection cause them to feel negative about themselves whenever anyone is at all critical of them or anything less than completely supportive of what they do. You can see now why the fear of honest confrontation is so prevalent in our society, why it undermines so much happiness and self-esteem. If you fear failure, you'll be afraid to make a mistake with another person. You'll be afraid that you may be proven wrong, and you'll avoid this at all costs. If you feel unworthy for any reason, you won't speak up when you disagree or in a tense situation involving other people because you really don't think that your feelings and opinions are of much value. You'll often allow people to override you and to dismiss your concerns as unimportant. You will tend to go along in order to get along. If you had a happy, supportive, positive, and exciting childhood, and you've grown up feeling wonderful about yourself, unafraid, uninhibited, and full of self-confidence and self-esteem, then what we're talking about here probably won't apply to you. But if you're among the majority, those who have grown up with fears of failure and rejection and feelings of guilt and unworthiness, then you know that these are really the greatest obstacles to the self-confidence that you need to deal effectively with difficult people. We discuss these fears in a little detail because everything in this program is aimed at giving you the specific tools that you need to overcome these fears and inhibitions. With this knowledge, you're just better equipped to build yourself up so that you become unstoppable as a person in everything you do. What we're really talking about here is assertiveness. Assertiveness really means the ability to be your own person and to stand up for yourself in every human interaction, no matter what the situation. Assertiveness is a skill, like typing with a typewriter or riding a bicycle, that you can learn with practice. The good news is that every time you behave assertively, the action itself causes you to feel more effective and your self-esteem and self-confidence goes up. It's almost like a magic button that you can push. But in order to learn something as vital to your success and happiness as assertiveness is not easy. When you attempt to learn anything, you move out of your comfort zone and into your zone of discomfort. Since your natural human tendency is to avoid discomfort of any kind, at any cost, your natural inclination will be to retreat back into your comfort zone. However, to grow, you must consciously resist this tendency and force yourself forward, even though the new behavior feels a little awkward and uncomfortable at first. The fact is that if you're not willing to endure the period of awkwardness that comes before competence and mastery, you never learn and grow and get better at anything. While you're experiencing the awkwardness which comes with saying or doing something that's unfamiliar, you work to relieve your feeling of discomfort by increasing your competence and ability rather than by regressing to your old ways. You resolve to stay the course. You stick with it until the new behavior starts to become comfortable. You begin to feel yourself developing a new level of competence, and eventually the new behavior will be as natural to you as the old one. but with one difference. You will be much more capable of getting the results you desire with the new behavior than you were with the old behavior or way of acting. In talking about assertiveness, it's very helpful for you to select a person that you really like and admire and want to be like. Much of your personality is formed by the people that you consciously and unconsciously look up to. So select a role model, a leader, a man or a woman who is calm and confident and self-assured. Whenever you find yourself in a situation with a difficult person, think about your role model and ask how that person would act in this situation. It's amazing how much this will help you and strengthen you. When I was in sales, for example, I would always think of General Patton with his aggressiveness and his boldness. When I'm dealing with another person, I try to think of Jesus or Albert Schweitzer and how kind and compassionate they might be. Many people create a whole series of role models that they refer to in each area of their day-to-day lives as it becomes necessary. Assertiveness basically means self-esteem. You are assertive to the degree to which you really like and respect yourself and consider your opinions and feelings valuable and worthy of being taken into consideration. The more you like yourself, the more naturally assertive you are, and the more effective you become in dealing with others, even the most difficult of other people. Assertiveness is a purely positive characteristic. There are two other behaviors that are on the opposite sides of assertiveness. You have to be aware of them because we all have a tendency to use them, and you see them demonstrated around you every day. The first of these behaviors is aggressiveness. Assertive behavior is not aggressive behavior. A person who is aggressive tends to be pushy, loud, demanding, overbearing, and obnoxious. A person who is aggressive uses this behavior because it's been successful for him or her in the past. It has become a conditioned response. It's their first line of defense. Whenever they feel themselves in a challenging situation, they switch on to aggressiveness and they begin speaking louder and faster in an attempt to overcome the opposition of the other party and get their way. Aggressiveness is a negative behavior that eventually backfires. It is an attempt to override another person and for someone to get what he wants without concern for what the other person gets. It's basically a form of win-lose negotiation where the aggressive person wins and the other person loses. Aggressiveness, which is closely associated with a superiority complex, is usually rooted in low self-esteem. Often, aggressive people have a very narrow repertoire of behaviors, and if aggressiveness doesn't work, they simply become even more aggressive. And if that doesn't work, they will often do exactly the opposite. They will back off and sulk and refuse to have anything to do with you. At the other end of the spectrum of behaviors is the quality of passiveness. Being passive means letting people run all over you and get what they want even at the sacrifice of your own best interests. People with deep fears of rejection or feelings of unworthiness often tend to resort to passiveness in any confrontation with other people. They would much rather be unhappy and angry inside rather than speak up and confront another person for any reason. Passiveness is also rooted in low self-esteem. Basically, the passive person does not feel that he or she is of much value, and therefore his or her opinion is not worthy of being considered. In the middle is assertiveness. The assertive person is neither passive nor aggressive. He or she is calm, positive, and firm. The assertive person knows exactly what he or she wants and at the same time respects the rights and requirements of others. The assertive person prefers to negotiate and compromise and reach a solution that's acceptable to all parties. The assertive person is quiet and persistent and very clear about his or her goals. And the assertive person is the most successful and effective person in dealing with difficult people. The first step in assertive behavior is for you to accept full responsibility for yourself and what you want. So use the word I rather than the word you. Be willing to say things like, I want, I need, I think, I feel, in my opinion, or it seems to me that, or I'm not happy with the existing situation. And in taking responsibility for your emotions, you can say something like, I feel unhappy or angry when you say or do such and such a thing. In each case, you remain firmly in control by taking responsibility for yourself and your feelings and expressing clearly what you think and feel. You are neither overbearing nor compromising. You are merely assertive. You do not blame or criticize. You merely state your truth calmly and without emotion. In dealing with difficult people, especially people who are angry or complaining, a valuable assertiveness technique is to be sympathetic and understanding and ask questions. It's very hard for a person to be angry for any period of time when you're asking questions and listening carefully to the answers. One of the most powerful sentences you can use in dealing with a person who is upset is this: I understand exactly how you feel. If I were in your situation, I'd feel the same way. Sometimes you can defuse a difficult situation simply by being willing to understand the other person. Often, all that a person needs is to know that someone else cares about how they feel and is attempting to understand their position. To assure that you will be assertive in a difficult situation when it arises, be sure to prepare mentally in advance. Use mental rehearsal. Walk through the situation in your own mind and see yourself responding calmly and quietly. See yourself relaxed and in complete control of the conversation. You can also use what is called the broken record technique. This method of assertiveness simply requires that you continue to repeat the same message over and over until it's accepted. In disciplining an employee or asking a child to do or not to do something, this technique is very effective. You ask your child to clean up his room. The child wants to argue or play or watch television and will clean up the room later and has 100 other reasons why the request is unreasonable. You simply respond by saying, I understand what you're saying, but I would like you to clean up your room right now. Whatever the child says, repeat the same words. If you repeat the same words often enough, eventually the other person will accept the message as being a fact and will stop arguing and start cooperating. This works equally well in most adult situations. Another powerful assertiveness technique is the use of silence. Often people say things to either provoke a comment or to get your agreement. You can often respond very effectively by saying nothing. If the other person tries to get you to say something, simply say, I have nothing to say at this time. One of the best of assertiveness techniques is the use of delay. My Japanese counterparts taught me some years ago that delay is the cruelest form of denial. Instead of saying no and getting into an argument, or saying yes and finding out later it was the wrong decision, simply delay. Put off a decision. Ask for time to think it over. If a person wants you to contribute time or money to a worthy cause and you're not sure that you care enough about this cause, simply delay making a decision. Tell the other person that this is an important decision and you would like a little time to turn it over in your mind. When you refuse to be rushed or coerced into saying or doing something, you feel much more in control of yourself and your life. Your self-esteem goes up. You feel more effective and your self-confidence increases. More than anything else, because of the law of reversibility, if you engage in the behaviors of a highly self-confident, assertive, and positive person, the actions themselves will actually create the feelings, beliefs, and values that go with them. By doing what you would do if you were exactly the person you would like to be, you will ultimately become that person. By using the other ideas you are learning in this course and practicing techniques like broken record, silence, delay, and the acceptance of responsibility in dealing with difficult people, you'll become more positive and assertive and eventually become a superior person with a superior personality. And the more effective you are in dealing with a wide range of behaviors at home and at work, the higher will be your self-confidence.